So, life is, the Buddha says that it's extremely difficult to, in this whole cycle of birth in different realms, to be born as a human being. Extremely difficult to be born as a human being, and to be a human being and then to come back again as a human being is really difficult. It's not as easy as you might think. And the life as a human being is considered to be a fortunate rebirth, because it's one in which you do have this capacity to abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, and to purify your mind. This is why we say the human being is, we say sat prasad. It's prasad in this capacity, not because we can think up wonderful technologies and we can do all these things to manipulate the external world, but because of the inner resources, inner capability we have. There's even an account of devas or tevada in the sutta, where the tevada is reached the end of his lifespan. And when tevadas reach the end of their lifespan, you can tell because like the flowers around their neck start to go moldy, and then there starts to be a smell comes from underneath their armpits. Tevadas don't have body odor until the last week of their life. And then when they start to get this odor coming from their armpits, you know, it's time for them to go. And in the suttas it says that the tevada with the right view, they come and wish the tevada who's leaving well. They said, may you be born in sukati. Quite good. In sukati. Lok manut. Mai chai sukati lok swan. Because it's there that you have the chance to practice the Dhamma freely and to progress in Dhamma. It's very difficult, not living in a Teva realm here, but you know, if any of you, most of you probably live quite, relatively speaking, very comfortable, lives. And the problem with a comfortable life is how easy it is to be heedless, lazy, indulgent. So you can imagine if you were in a Teva realm, how much more likely it is that you would be lazy, heedless, and indulgent. So unless you actually deal with those kinds of mental states and are able to transcend them in this lifetime, then they're going to control and manipulate you wherever you're born. And this is the world in which you can be free. Buddha once said to the monks, he said, all the water and all the oceans, just imagine how much that is, he said, is less than the tears that have fallen from your eyes in previous lives. If you were to, every single tear that you've ever shed in all your past life was all gathered together in one spot, there would be more water there than in a huge ocean. And so, you know, this just goes on and on and on. Yeah, there's a like new age, you know, in the West you've got this idea of you sort of stairway to heaven, you know, you can reborn all this time, you just get better and better and purer, and then finally, you know, you bliss out and everything's wonderful. But in Buddhist teaching is that there's no happy ending unless you you develop the Eightfold Path. You just go round and round and round and round. There's no end to it. So this is why Buddhist teachings are so valuable. Okay, does anyone have anything else? We've still got a few more minutes.
Yes. Can you just go back to the subject on trying to become Buddhist in a bit? Is it true that some monks say that the chanting of Prabhupada at funeral is more for the living one rather than the dead?
Hard to say. Firstly, One doesn't. Very few people have the, even monks, only one, a very, very small proportion of monks have the psychic powers to know where people go after they die and what realm they're born in. There are monks who know these things. They can tell you, oh yeah, he was born in this, he's been reborn in this realm, he's been reborn in that realm, although they won't speak about these things with lay people. But to whether or not the departed one is there and listening, of course, very, very few people know, and it's probably unlikely. So monks will often say, yes, it's for the living rather than the dead. To give, and again, it's part of this response to a lot of criticism, you know, that's been heard over the past few years of, you know, we go to these Yansop and go through all the traffic jams and we get there, you know, and what is there? It's just this chanting we don't understand. And I think monks have been trying to find ways to explain and to encourage people to make use of this these gnans in order to you know, make them more worthwhile. They're telling people, it's, if people think that the gnan is for the departed, then, you know, it's nothing to do with them, just as long as they sit there and they're seen and they say hello to the family and just show the outward respect. But as I was saying, if you understand that you know, this is an opportunity not only to pay respects to the person who's passed away, but actually to create merit and to share it with them, so that if they are in a place where they are in need of that merit and can receive it and can anumotana in that merit, then they will. And it's something that should be done and is a beautiful thing to do and a very useful thing to do. Anybody else? Anybody like to ask anything? Say anything? Write a question on a piece of paper? The Buddha's teachings, the Buddha never intended to create a kind of philosophical system, like a watertight philosophical system. What he was teaching was a path of liberation. The teachings of the Buddha are a path of liberation. And so he taught on many different levels, to many different people, many different places over a period of 45 years. So if you compare, let's say compare the volume of teachings, you think of, say, like Jesus, who was teaching for about, what, 6 months or a year, and the Buddha was teaching for 45 years. The number of the teachings is incredible, and the range of teachings is remarkable. The Buddha teaching from a basic level of even of how to be a good merchant, how to run a business, right up to the level of the very subtle mental states experienced in the high levels of meditation and liberation. The Buddha also studiously refused to answer questions that did not lead to liberation. To use a modern phrase, life's too short. He said, as our life is short, we should choose the questions and choose to pursue those things that have ultimate value. I mean, you can see in modern world, I mean, how many billions and billions of pounds and dollars have been spent on these particle accelerator tunnels? There's one in Switzerland, and to try and find out, you know, what happened directly after the Big Bang, you know, and So what? You know, even if you knew, as far as I'm concerned, not really very excited. Well, the whole thing about, you know, I was talking about who can urinate the highest. You know, the whole thing would be, you know, it's not just an individual thing. You see, it's between countries, isn't it? You know, whose economy can grow the fastest? Who's got the biggest building? You know, oh, Malaysia had the biggest building. Now it's Taiwan. Now it's going to be China. We've got the biggest building in the world. We've got the biggest, the richest. It's this kind of childish competition. Then in America and Russia, you know, this great competition to put somebody on the moon. And then how ridiculous was that? And then, and of course, it's believed that America actually did it, although you probably know there's quite a lot of people who think they didn't really, and they filmed the whole moon landing in a desert in America. But you say, well, yes, we spent all this money on sending somebody to the moon, but there's been all these incredible spin-offs which have benefited the human race. And you say, well, what? They say, well, Velcro, you know, it's just sort of... justify the whole space program, you know, because we've got Velcro now. And so much money, so much effort is spent on things which are ultimately meaningless. And how many people's working lives are spent producing meaningless items? I mean, this is part of the cause of so much mental illness in the world today, where you spend so much of your life slaving away doing something which is, you know, ultimately meaningless. And so Dhamma practice is something which requires us to really go into this question of meaning. You know, what's meaningful? What's something that we can be really proud of in our life? Now, the Buddha taught a path of liberation. I would say that probably the Indian society 2,500 years ago is probably the most sophisticated, intellectually sophisticated society in the history of the world. I would say certainly, I think there are good arguments to suggest that people were more intellectually advanced 2,500 years ago in India than they are today. I think there's quite a lot of evidence for that. Whether or not you accept that point, there was a great deal of interest in philosophical questions about the nature of the world, the nature of existence, the nature of the universe, and so on. And the Buddha just wouldn't participate in all of that. But what happened after the Buddha died and monastic communities spread out throughout India, we're in a whole kind of different world now without the Buddha as a leader, and having to cope with isolated monastic communities developing their own kind of slant and emphasis in the teachings, and different agreements about what's really the heart of the teachings and what's not. Different views about the Dhamma practice, and also the dialogue with members of the other religious traditions. And this is what led to this effort to systematize the Buddha's teachings, to go into the teachings and to try to create some kind of philosophical, psychological system, which would then could be learned, could be transmitted, and really this is what Buddhism's all about. And this, in my view, is the source of the Abhidhamma. You know, it wasn't that the Buddha went up to Dawadung and taught his mother, and then, I mean, this is a legend to justify the Abhidhamma tradition, which was created subsequently. This is my particular view, and many people won't agree with me on this. But because, as I say, there wasn't the kind of communication that we have today, and the different groups and different Nikai sped up, and every Nikai had their own Abhidhamma. So Well, in the history of Buddhism, you see that the suttas, which means the talks, the Dhamma talks of the Buddha, have been accepted. And there are Pali versions, Sanskrit versions, Chinese versions. They're all almost identical. And the Vinaya, the discipline of the Buddhist monks, is also pretty much agreed on all the different schools of Buddhism around the world. But where the real differences arose were in Abhidhamma. And I think that the differences in the Abhidhamma teachings and the conflicts in Abhidhamma teachings between the different schools are a good proof of the fact that they were not originally taught by the Buddha. Now, my view is if you want to really get to the heart of Buddhist teachings, you can bypass the Abhidhamma and go straight to the Dhamma talks, the Dhamma discourses that the Buddha taught. And these are very accessible now. Although the Thai Tripitaka and the suttas in Thai language can still be rather difficult to read because of the style of Thai that's used. There are modern translations by people like Jan Satim Pogwanabok, Jan Wasin Indasarat, for instance, which are a lot easier to read. But I would also recommend anyone interested in the study of Buddhist teachings from the primary source to go to the English translations, which have been produced by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's an American bhikkhu who lived in, American monk who lived in Sri Lanka for many years and was the president of Buddhist Publication Society in Sri Lanka. And the most important, the sutta collections have been translated by him, and they can easily be found either in good bookshops in the West, they're printed by Wisdom Publications, or you can order them over the internet. But if you're interested in studying the Buddha's words from his own mouth, as it were, rather than commentators, and then the suttas are really where you want to go. So there's a lot of confusion. What does Nikai mean? In the time of India, there was all these different Nikai, and then people get it confused in Thailand with the Thammayut Nikai and Mahanikai. These are two different things. Unfortunately, we just don't really have the words to be able to distinguish them. But in Thailand, the monks for many hundreds of years were pretty well autonomous, and there were distinct monastic traditions. You had the monastic traditions of the monks in the north and in central Thailand and Isan and northeast Thailand, and there was no kind of central authority over the Sangha. And then the Sangha in Thailand went through some very difficult periods, probably the most traumatic of which followed the sacking of Ayutthaya by the Burmese 1767, which was traumatic for everyone, but the monastic order suffered a lot. And so we can see from the beginning of the Jakri dynasty that every one of the kings, beginning with the first Rajakantinin Benton, start to issue laws and regulations meant on improving the quality of the monastic order. And this process reached its culmination with the Rajagantisi. And before he became king, if you remember, while his brother was king, he became a monk and was very disillusioned by what he saw in the monkhood, generally speaking, in Thailand. And he did find one community of monks which he thought were very inspiring, and these were the monks of the Mon tradition. And this was the tradition that he affiliated himself with and began a kind of a new group of monks. And these were based in Wat Bawan and some other monasteries in Bangkok. And this is the sect that became known as the Thammayut sect. And the Thammayut sect were distinguished by an effort to go back to the source. It's what in academic discourse we would call like a Protestant sect. You say go back to the original teachings, get rid of all the superstitions and the siasat and all the wrong behavior and practices. So it was an academic, elitist, academic, intellectual tradition based in Bangkok, and one which was largely composed of aristocrats, members of the royal family. And then when King Mongkut Ratchakan Tisi became king, then he gave royal sponsorship to this sect, looking on it as a group of monks that might purify the larger Sangha. And so this led to kind of missionary efforts, and during the time of Ratchakan Tiha in the time of King Chulalongkorn, where there was an effort to transform Thailand into a modern nation state on the lines of England or France or any of these countries, then part and parcel of that effort to create a nation state was to create a unified monastic order using the Thammayut monks as the transformative force. So we can say that the Thammayut monks, Thammayut arise first and Mahanikaya came after, because what Mahanikaya meant was all the monks who are not Thammayut. It wasn't like there was this group called Mahanikaya, it just meant everybody else. And in the time of King Chulalongkorn, then this Thammayut sect became officially established as a Nikaya. So now you had this split into the Thammayut Nikaya and the Mahanikaya. But the differences between them have always been really very minor. There are no differences in terms of the affiliation with the Theravada Buddhist tradition and the understanding of the Buddhist teachings and the acceptance of the Tripitaka, the Tripitok, and so on. There were differences between them in matters of minor monastic etiquette, the way that the robes are worn, the bowl, certain kind practice of certain vinaya rules, and so on. But in fact, it's a very minor kind of difference. We can say, overall, Buddhism in Thailand is extremely unified. It's very strong. I mean, if you compare it with say other religious traditions, with the huge differences between the different sects of Islam, the Shia, Sunni, Wahhabi, so on and so forth. These are differences in belief, differences, quite major differences in the idea of what it means to be a Muslim, and what a true Muslim is, and what a false Muslim is. Whereas in Thailand, the difference between Thammayut Mahanikaya is a very minor matter of monastic etiquette and doesn't affect the body of Buddhists generally. It's not a matter of belief or view. It's something which is quite insignificant. Okay, so that's just a sort of quick summary of Buddhist history in the last Buddhist monastic history. Yeah, I've got another couple of questions. Maybe we can answer these this afternoon. So, assuming it doesn't rain, so you can all pawana, mechay ko fon, ko mimi fon, then this afternoon after the sitting we'll walk out to the lotus pond where we were going yesterday before it started to rain. But for now I think it's all lunchtime, so we can finish.